On Tech News Today, the New York Times bashes Amazon for making employees cry. The Times and ProPublica expose AT&T's special relationship with the NSA. And we've got new details on the Apple Car, on Facebook's bid to become a blogging platform, and on Google's new drive to get you on solar power. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Monday, August 17th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news of the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin. Welcome to the show, one and all. Our co-anchor today is CNET.com Editor-in-Chief Lindsay Turrentine. Hey, Lindsay, how you doing?
Hey, Mike. I am great, and I'm ready for a big show.
Yeah, so am I. And why don't we jump right into it? We have a bunch of really great guests today to talk about some really great stories, including some very important ones. So let's jump right into it. The New York Times published a scathing takedown of Amazon's workplace practices and culture over the weekend. The piece described Amazon as a place where workers are encouraged to tear apart one another's ideas in meetings, are forced to work long hours and be available to answer emails late into the night, and where people often cry at their desks. Well, who doesn't? Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos Sunday responded in a letter to employees and said he didn't recognize the workplace portrayed in the article and that Amazon would not tolerate the shockingly callous management practices described in the piece. Lindsay Turrentine, what do you make of all this? Is the New York Times accurately portraying what Amazon is like internally, or is Jeff Bezos more correct in that it's not really that bad?
Well, I mean, there's no way to know, really. Amazon has historically been extremely secretive, maybe even more so than the likes of Apple. It's really rare to hear about what's going on behind closed doors at Amazon. So, you know, we don't have a lot of evidence other than what the New York Times reported. I tend to believe the New York Times, great institution, good journalists. It doesn't seem like they would publish something this aggressive without doing some serious research. I also just anecdotally, friends who have interviewed at Amazon. I have one friend in particular who shall remain unnamed who went through the whole interview process, was offered a job, and ultimately just kind of shrugged and said, you know what? I get such a bad vibe from this. It's just from the process and the arrogance therein that person just walked away. And I think that that's kind of not uncommon. And part of what the article points out is that this is a liability for Amazon. People don't really stay very long, or often don't, because it's just not worth it.
Yeah. And, you know, Jeff Bezos is clearly, he's a brilliant genius, and he's quite an innovator. And apparently he believes that the thing that kills big companies, they start out small and they're lean, right? And they're flexible and fast. And then they grow to be a big company. And then inertia and bureaucracy weighs them down and causes them to become mediocre. And he apparently wants to prevent that by having all kinds of principles that everybody has to memorize and specific lists of rules. I believe there are 14 rules that all employees have to live by. And whether this is an oppressive environment, I would hazard to guess that it probably depends on your own personality. There are some people who would thrive in a workplace, even the one that that is described in this company, in this article by the New York Times. But clearly, there's something different about this company. And I think that much is clear. And I'm sure that we'll hear more from employees and others. Sometimes you can't quite trust disgruntled employees. On the other hand, there is a whole lot of anecdotes in this. It's anecdotal, but there are a whole lot of anecdotes in this article.
Well, and what's so interesting about this article is that a lot of these, the folks speaking on the record in the article, were actually cleared by Amazon. So it seems like this is kind of a surprise to Amazon, but actually some of the reporting was it was on the record.
Yeah.
Had permission.
Where do we hear from the people who didn't have permission? You know, this is the other interesting aspect of this is that, of course, Amazon is based in Seattle, near Redmond, Washington, where Microsoft is based. Microsoft used to have something of a reputation like this, where Bill Gates used to like scream at everybody and like you know, had to work incredibly long hours. So the moral of the story is, if you want to get into tech, come to Silicon Valley, where you can have all the jolt and Fruit Loops you can eat and bring your dog to work. Don't go to Seattle. It sounds like a Orwellian dystopia nightmare up there. Just kidding. I'm sure it's very nice to work up there. Well, we got some breaking news for you. The M version of Android has now been identified with a sugary product, and that product is marshmallow. There it is. This
you
was
know,
announced by David Burke, who is an engineer at Google. What do you think about this, Lindsay?
I just don't like marshmallows. It's just disappointing to me personally. I really, really, really don't like marshmallows.
With all the camping you do and like all the outdoor stuff you do, they're soft and fluffy.
Okay. If perfectly, perfectly toasted, they're acceptable.
Of course.
I hope that my Android install is not toasted.
I hope so too. And I think I was pulling for marshmallow and also M&Ms, but I'm not sure if I said that out loud on the show. I may have.
But Lindsay, now that you say it, toasted would be a perfect name for an OS on the marshmallow device.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's do it. Side project.
Oh, man. Unbelievable. Well, you heard it here first, folks. Marshmallow is the new version of Android. There it is. It makes for a great statue, too. They have so many versions. How many statues can that campus hold before the ground collapses underneath their feet? Well, we got some more news for you coming right up. But first, let's talk about succeeding in life. Let's talk about ZipRecruiter, who's bringing you this episode of Tech News Today, our sponsor today. ZipRecruiter, you know, there's so many benefits to it that you hear a lot about. You hear about how fast it is, how easy it is, how you can design your communication with the world using your company's branding, and how you can get all these kind of benefits from the company while they filter the incoming responses. But the bottom line is, the real benefit is in the quality of the person you hire. That will be with you for years. You really want to hire the very best people possible. And that's really the best thing about ZipRecruiter. You can post 100 plus job sites with a single click. And what that means is that you're going to find the best person no matter where they are. The best person is going to find you as well. It's a great way to start with that 100 plus job sites, but they also have a massive resume database with more than 4 million resumes. That's more people than lots of countries have in them. And of course, ZipRecruiter is used by over 400,000 businesses, and you can try it for free. And we're going to tell you how to do that. 30,000 new businesses sign up each and every month. We have a user testimonial from a happy ZipRecruiter client named Vivian, who said, "I signed up for an account and didn't expect a customer service call until it came time for me to apply for a paid subscription. But just after an hour after signing up, I got an excellent call from Jeff, a customer service rep. In the first 2 days, I found 2 quality candidates." Once again, the most important thing about any job search is the quality of the candidates, and ZipRecruiter is the way to find them. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And check it out. We thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. In a huge expose jointly published by ProPublica and the New York Times, 6 prominent journalists have collaborated to reveal the extent of AT&T cooperation with the National Security Agency over many years. Jeff Larson is one of those journalists, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Hey, nice to meet you, Mike.
Nice to meet you as well. Now, didn't all the major telecoms work with the NSA? What's so special about AT&T's NSA relationship?
So what we see in AT&T's relationship with the NSA is we see an extremely collaborative partnership. There are, you know, laws on the books. There are certain warrants and executive orders that telecoms do have to comply with, all the way down to from local police departments to the DEA to national security orders. But what we see in this relationship is we see an extremely close, highly collaborative relationship where sometimes even in the case of spying on the UN, AT&T engineers helped the NSA decode the data coming in from those pipes.
So at the very end of this piece, AT&T's comment is, "We do not voluntarily provide information to any investigating authorities other than if a person's life is in danger and time is of the essence." Do you think that AT&T stopped doing this a while ago, or what is the status of AT&T's relationship with the NSA?
It's hard to tell because the documents that we have come from, the newest document is 2013, right? So since then, we've seen the Snowden upheavals. We've seen Verizon who is part of an or was a part of a NSA program called Stormbrew, actually tried to sue, challenge the thing in court. We've also seen the USA Freedom Act pass. We've seen there was a presidential directive where Obama said that foreigners have rights too. So it's unclear whether or not the program's exactly the same as it was in 2013. But in 2013, I think that that comment by AT&T is a little bit strange, because we do see this in we see AT&T engineers tasking selectors. We also see the fact that they hand over transit data. And as far as I can tell, there is a transit authority at NSA. So transit means communications transiting the United States. So going from maybe Germany to the United States to, Africa or something like that. Those communications aren't covered under American law, right? Because they're foreigners. So I think that there is... what we see in the documents is we see this highly collaborative relationship, and we also see the fact that they refer to it as a partnership, right? So it seems above and beyond and at odds with what AT&T told us.
Now, you wrote that AT&T shared literally billions of emails with the NSA and shared literally hundreds of billions of chunks of metadata with the NSA. What is the legal authority under which they did that? Is this somewhere in the terms of service that customers sign somewhere? Or what gave them the right to hand all this over?
So there are, like I mentioned one already, which is the transit authority, which was some sort of opinion that we don't have the text of. So I don't really know much about it. But there are two other types of orders. There's FISA Amendments Act orders, and there are FISA orders. And one has to do with foreign emails or communications. That means someone is communicating outside of the United States to inside of the United States. In that case, the NSA just needs reasonable, articulable suspicion of foreign intelligence value. So that allows them to scoop up a whole bunch of communications. The other type is purely domestic, right? So we're seeing in the business records orders, so Verizon handing over all metadata phone calls, and AT&T, what's new in this report is in the past, the government had said that those business record orders were about only landline phone calls or largely landline phone calls. What we see here is we see billions of cell phone records being sent over, and that's entirely new, right? So that's a large portion of the cell phone calls made in the United States. Now, it's just metadata. It's who calls who. But as we've seen again and again and again, metadata is identifiable.
So, Jeff, one of the things that's so alluring about a story like this, in this piece, you have written that NSA doesn't identify AT&T by name. There are a lot of clues that point directly to AT&T. There's also a code name for this program, Fairview. Can you tell us a little bit more about what Fairview is?
Yeah. Fairview covers the partnership. So it's a code name for the partnership. They also have Fairview engineers at NSA, which in theory, I think, are the ones, for example, that worked on the UN spying operation. Fairview engineers, they're the ones that deal with the interconnect between AT&T systems and NSA systems. It was a long haul trying to prove that Fairview was AT&T definitively, which is why I think it's taken other folks, they haven't done it in 2 years. We started in February to do this. What we found is we found a bunch of internal AT&T jargon. We also went back to FCC records about cable landing stations, so the transoceanic cables that go underneath the United States to bring internet traffic into the United States. We also had several former intelligence officials confirm to us that Fairview was AT&T. As a sort of a cherry on top, we were able to confirm that another special source operations program, special source operations is the division within the NSA, Stormbrew included Verizon. And You know, my favorite piece of evidence about how we were able to prove Fairview had to deal with the Japanese earthquake. So the earthquake knocked out cable offline, and we were able to call up NTT Communications in Japan and confirm that that cable came back online when the NSA said they resumed collection.
Unbelievable. Well, we're just scratching the surface here, folks. You want to read the whole piece at ProPublica.org. It's already also published in the New York Times and on the New York Times website, but it's much easier to find at ProPublica.org. Jeff Larson is, of course, at ProPublica.org and on Twitter at TheJeffLarson. Thank you so much, TheJeffLarson. Appreciate you coming on the show today. All right. Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
Well, IBM and Canonical today announced a partnership to build a version of Linux for mainframes. It's called Linux One. Ron Miller wrote about it for TechCrunch and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Ron.
Hey, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Now, why is Linux right for mainframes, and why are mainframes right for Linux? I think most people think of Linux as something that you wouldn't find on a mainframe.
That's true. But if you actually look at the history of Linux, it actually has been running on mainframes for 15 years, and IBM was actually the company that introduced that. Now, the question is, why did they team up with Canonical and to put Ubuntu Linux on a line of mainframes? And that has more to do with, I think, the popularity of Ubuntu, and that IBM was seeing, Ubuntu and a number of customers, and decided that they would team up with them and make some machines that would appeal to that end of the market.
So what do we know about the hardware, about these actual mainframes that are going to offer Linux One? Can you tell us a little bit more about them?
I only know about the high-end one, which is called, and I have to look at the article to get the name.
It was a Penguin name, right?
It's the Emperor, I'm sorry. Yeah. It's the Emperor and the Rock Hopper, you know. So you can't say IBM doesn't have a sense of humor here.
You cannot.
The Emperor is the Z13 mainframe that was introduced at the beginning of this year, and it'll be running, a version of Ubuntu Linux, and it's supposed to be extremely powerful, and will also run, a bunch of Linux Enterprise software that would include things like, Apache Spark, Node.js, MongoDB, MariaDB, and so forth. So all these things will sort of come together to create, pretty much an open source solution on a mainframe setting, which is, pretty interesting, I think.
It certainly is. And, I think I can understand why Canonical would want to work with IBM. They have a whole bunch of customers. But why would IBM work with Canonical? It seems like an odd partnership from IBM's perspective.
It does in a way. But I think that, as I said at the beginning, I think that if you think about it, Ubuntu is a pretty popular flavor of Linux, both on the consumer side and the enterprise side. And I think IBM was really, they were running into it, and customers were demanding it. And it became, sort of a sensible approach for them. And, IBM has been looking for an edge over these last months in various market settings. And this is just another way for them to introduce open source into a part of the market that maybe people didn't think it was that extensive.
Yeah, and I think a lot of us tend to think of mainframes as being yesterday's technology. It's like dead and gone for the most part, but it's really a big business for IBM, isn't it?
Well, it's a good sized business, I think. They say they sell between 10 and 20 per quarter, which may not seem like a large number, but when you consider probably the size of the sale, it's probably pretty substantial. They're not popular anymore in the same way that, obviously other types of computing are popular, but they still have a pretty substantial market in certain settings, whether that's finance, certain university settings, and, other places that require really intensive compute kinds of modes that maybe, the cloud and other kinds of computing options just don't provide.
Very interesting. Ron Miller is at facebook.com/reporter.ron, reporter.ron on Facebook, and also on Twitter at Ron_Miller. Ron Miller, thank you so much for joining us today on Tech News Today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
The pleasure was all mine. Liberty has acquired Zulily. If you're not super familiar with these companies, Liberty is best known for owning the TV home shopping channel QVC, and Zulily is an e-commerce company. Akin Oyedele is a reporter for Business Insider and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Akin.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. Now, can you briefly describe what kind of retailer Zulily is? What do they sell exactly?
So Zulily targets moms and mothers with children. I think that's the best way to describe the products they sell. So it's everything from children's dresses to shoes to toys. And it's more geared towards moms with mothers' children as opposed to the moms themselves. So that's basically what they sell.
So it's mostly children's products, but it's aimed at mothers because, of course, they're the ones with jobs and money.
Exactly.
So I have some experience with Zulily because I've shopped there, and I guess I'm the target market. I'm a mom. I have kids. A lot of clothes there, a lot of sort of flash sale items. It's kind of like Guilt Group, but for moms or for a certain kind of lady. Do you know what QVC is going to do with this kind of outfit? I mean, it seems to have been fairly successful, but with some financial struggles. How is this going to help a retailer like QVC who has this kind of very old-fashioned model of selling things through the TV?
Right. So it's still quite unclear what exactly QVC and Liberty want from Zulily, although, of course, by absorbing this smaller web-focused e-commerce company, they might be able to maybe break out of that traditional, you know, TV mode and really expand online. Although I must mention that QVC already has an e-commerce presence on the web. But, I'm sure they see some potential in this company, and they, you know, like I said, it's unclear exactly what they want at this stage, but they definitely see a convergence in the strategies of, you know, putting on flash sales and trying to give people the best deals that they can get.
Now, if people are unfamiliar with Zulily, they might think that this is something of a small acquisition, but the acquisition actually placed a market value on Zulily. Can you tell us what that market value is?
It was $2.4 billion. It could definitely have been more if Liberty had bought the company, say, in February of last year when Zulily's share price was at about $70. Right now it's at about $18. So it's come down in value, but it's still definitely $2.4 billion is not a small market value.
So Liberty's getting it at a little bit of a discount because they're on a kind of a downward spiral. Hopefully they'll revive it and turn it into a thriving business once again. Akin Oyedele is at businessinsider.com and on Twitter at Akin Oyedele, just like it sounds. Thank you so much for joining us today, Akin.
Thank you for having me.
All right, bye-bye. Samsung is well known for interesting and innovative smartphone hardware, but their software strategy might be even more interesting and more innovative. The Verge's Ben Popper wrote a long-form feature on the strategy, and he joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. Now, we tried to get you on Friday, and we couldn't quite pull it off, but we're so glad that you're here today because this is really a fascinating article. Now, what is Samsung's strategy for software innovation?
So what they're trying to do is similar to, I think, a move a lot of big tech companies make, bring in innovation and disruptive people so that you don't get too comfortable. Maybe something along the lines of a Xerox PARC or an AT&T Bell Labs. They've got incubator accelerators here in New York and also out in Palo Alto. And basically, they accept startup companies in. They give them a lot of benefits, a salary, you know, healthcare, food, you know, obviously a space to work with lots of great technology. And then they often will acquire those companies if it seems like there's going to be some interesting synergy with Samsung's hardware. And I guess kind of the point where my story leaves off is, will that be a success starting, you know, in the next year? We're going to see American startup software baked into the phone, the television, and the Internet of Things, which is kind of their three most important consumer-facing categories.
So this is all started by Samsung's David Yoon. Can you tell us a little bit more about Mr. Yoon and what he is going for, how his background might have led him to want to establish this?
Sure. So David came up through the media world. He was at NBC and Time Warner. Then Time Warner merged with AOL, and he came more into the tech world. He went from AOL to Google, where he helped shepherd through the YouTube acquisition, and then more recently to Samsung. And I think, you know, he has a lot of credibility in the world of digital media and in the world of startups. And what he's trying to do is to merge two very different cultures. And that is both in terms of America and South Korea, but also in terms of a hardware manufacturing giant and a nimble software startup. So he's trying to figure out a way to get those two sides to work together and be productive and, you know, to create successful integrations, which is a notoriously difficult thing to do.
Now, we've reported on this show, of course, about the acquisition by Samsung of companies like SmartThings, of Loop Pay, which we heard from again at their big announcement last week, and Pixie. What are the important, how does Samsung look at the importance of these acquisitions to its future in terms of where it wants to dominate in different markets?
Sure. So, I mean, I think Samsung is still, you know, a large and profitable company, but their profits have been shrinking. And, you know, they at one point they were selling the most smartphones in the world, and that pole position is now occupied again by Apple. So I think they realize that in the world of Android, they can't compete for the lower segment of the market. There's no margin there. So they have to move up market and compete more directly with Apple. And I think for them, that means offering premium features that come from the integration of hardware and software. And Loop Pay is probably the best example of that. They acquire this Boston-based startup, and now their new flagship phones will have the ability to swipe and pay at any magstripe reader. So that's something Apple Pay can't offer. And that's the kind of integration, I think, that they're looking to get out of these startups.
So we've talked on this show in the past about Boxy and Samsung acquiring Boxy. And that right. not going so well. What happened there? And is this a potential path for some of these other acquisitions? Or do you think that Samsung has learned from past mistakes?
Yeah. So Boxy was acquired by the GIC team, by David and his team. And the distinction was that they were immediately integrated directly into the television unit and reported straight to people in Korea. And I think that that is now seen as a mistake. I think that with the startups that come out of GIC, they have a team of nearly 20 people in Korea who act as liaisons, these go-betweens who can help negotiate the sort of politics and cultural frictions that might emerge. And the integration of Pixie onto the TV is kind of the ideal. That is how you want it to work. A small software startup is now a feature on the TV. It's got its own button on the remote. With Boxy, unfortunately, you know, the integration did not go well, and the large project they were working on together was killed. So I think those are two sides of the same coin. You know, Boxy is a story of how you don't want things to go. Pixie, maybe how you do want things to go. You know, time will tell if these new software features, whether that's SmartThings or Loop Pay or Pixie, mean more people go out and buy Samsung products. We don't know that yet, but we do know that, yeah, Boxy was an example of what happens when an integration is not successful. And some of the startups at GIC on the other side seem to be an example of how that team is shepherding software startups through what can be a very difficult process. There's a real culture clash there. It's two different worlds. And, you know, I hope that doesn't sound jingoistic in any way. You know, that came from both the American startups and the Korean executives. You know, everyone was openly willing to discuss that. And I don't think yet.
Well, you know, this is a great article, and you can find it at TheVerge.com's at the website for The Verge, and you can search for Samsung's Big Bet. That will find the article. Ben Popper's at TheVerge.com and on Twitter at Ben Popper. Ben, thank you so much for sharing your article with us today on Tech News Today.
Thanks for having me on.
The Guardian reported in an exclusive that Apple's self-driving car project may be further along than assumed. The paper said Apple is scouting for secure locations in the San Francisco Bay Area to test the car. They have documents that prove that Apple met with officials from a 2,100-acre former naval base near San Francisco called the Gomentum Station, which was built during World War II and has both 20 miles of paved highways and is guarded by the U.S. military. It sounds perfect for Apple. This piece also mentioned that Cook previously met with the CEO of Fiat Chrysler. Apple has also been hiring engineers from Mercedes and Tesla and also from car battery maker A123 Systems. Looks like this is going to happen, Lindsay Turrentine, unless Apple's just willing, because they have so many billions of dollars, to just throw this away on just checking it out. Do you think they're really, really serious about building a self-driving car?
you know, my gut feeling or my sort of pat normal answer would be like, no, this doesn't make sense with Apple's business model, that the margins aren't there. But then it just keeps, this keeps coming back, and it keeps coming back over and over again. And I love that these documents came from a Public Records Act request, right? It's not even that hidden. The Guardian just went and asked to find some of these communications. That makes it look more and more serious. I think my instinct might be wrong in this case. And Apple's looking at this and saying, look, this is just important for our brand.
I think the case for a consumer electronics giant like Apple to make a car is as follows. I mean, in the past, we've looked at cars as these big, clunky, greasy, mechanical objects that, that are not, high tech. They're kind of low tech. But in fact, cars today are high tech, and cars tomorrow will be extremely high tech. There are computers that control the brakes, the batteries, the steering, the everything. It's one computer system after another. I believe that my Prius, which is not even a recent model Prius, has 8 computers in it. And of course, it's a user interface experience, both analog user interface conventions like a steering wheel, for example, and lots of digital ones, including a media interface. And I just think that companies like Google and Apple look at a car as just a consumer electronics device on wheels. And you mentioned margins. If anybody can make high margins on cars, it's Apple.
If anybody can make high margins on anything, it's Apple. The other thing, I mean, you're right. The other thing that's interesting about self-driving cars as opposed to just any, today car experience is that the self-driving car is going to become essentially, this is how I think about it, a giant screen. Right? Because what are you going to be doing in that car? You're going to be consuming media. And Apple is really right now working very hard on making money from the media business. And it's a huge opportunity for them to do that.
My basic view about Apple is that they are in the transformation of the user of content consumption, user experience. And so in the old days, they were a computer company and they made computers. And of course, that has a user interface experience that they kind of, they didn't invent it, obviously, but they pushed it into the mainstream to a certain extent and championed certain conventions in PC user interfaces. But when Steve Jobs came back in the late 90s and reinvented the company, the first thing they tackled was the user interface around audio, listening to music, basically. The, iTunes and the iPod transformed that. And years later, they decided that the user interface experience for consuming content on the smartphone was sorely lacking, so they came out with the iPhone, and then they did it again with the iPad. You know, if you recall, when they came out with the iPad, basically a tablet was like a Windows tablet that was super expensive, heavy, thick, and pen-based, and they transformed that. So I really do think that they see a car as a, like you say, as a media experience, and it's a horrible experience. I mean, let's face it, car dashboard entertainment systems are terrible. They're clunky, they're non-intuitive. People don't embrace all the features because they're confusing. And so they want to reinvent that. And what better way than to actually create a car company, I guess. All right, well, developer Dave Weiner pointed out on Twitter today that Facebook has redesigned Notes to look like the publishing site Medium. The change may be designed to convince bloggers to switch to Facebook as a blogging platform. Posts are wide and have a large cover image. The typography is clean and spacious. Facebook told The Verge that they are testing an update to Notes to make it easier for people to create and read longer form stories on Facebook. The update is available only to a small group of people, but I'm pretty sure, Lindsay Turrentine, that this is going to be what Notes looks like. And I think Dave Weiner has it exactly right. They want to make Facebook a blogging platform.
Yeah, I mean, this is super smart, right? Like Facebook's huge power is in its number of users. And the reality is, if I wanted to write something and I wanted to make sure that the people who are most important to me see it and get a chance to participate with it, and this were available to me, I might choose this over Medium. Medium's great if you want to get something out in the marketplace or you just want, strangers to read it. But if you want everybody to read what you see, but specifically the people you're closest to, Facebook has got to be the most powerful way to do it, love Facebook or not.
Well, at least 10% of them, their algorithm for filtering what gets into people's news feeds are going to fail to deliver that to most people. But I get your point. That's where everybody spends huge amounts of time. And of course, if you put it out there on a blog somewhere, if you launch a blog today, you know, the number of people who see it will be zero until you use social media to drive traffic to it somehow. So that's a tougher way to go. And of course, on sites like Facebook and even Google Plus, nobody wants to leave anymore. They don't want to click on a link and go to another site to consume media or to read something. So it makes a lot of sense to make Facebook the actual blogging platform. And you know, I did that with Google Plus. I used it as a blogging platform actively and deliberately. I canceled my old blog and used Google Plus. And social networks are fantastic blogging platforms. I mean, not Twitter, obviously, but Facebook and a site like Facebook is a great place to blog, actually. So I'm a big believer in that. We kind of get locked into our canned definitions of what a blog is, what a social network is. In fact, you're just posting words for people to read with a picture to go with it or a video, and that works really well on social media.
Agree.
Well, all right. Well, Google this morning released a new site called Project Sunroof, which tells you about solar energy collection in your area based on your address. It'll tell you how much sun energy is beating down on your house. It can then calculate how much money you would save by leasing solar panels. You can find the site at google.com/get/sunroof. This is really a great idea, I think, Lindsay, because, in fact, you do save, you know, solar panels usually pay for themselves if you're patient. And if you do it right, they pay for themselves and then start paying you back. So it makes a lot of sense for people. And I don't think people realize that. They just see it as a huge investment.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a pretty, probably a fairly easy thing for Google to do. Google's so good at data collection. I actually have a friend who's working on a similar project himself. And one of the challenges of this type of project is getting all the data that you need from all of the different solar companies and all the different grids, right? I mean, there are so many different electrical carriers, whether it's PG&E or anything else. I don't even know all of the ones around the country. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. It's difficult to do the kind of thing that Google is very, very good at.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. Well, the news you can lose, a Chinese company didn't want to copy the Xbox or the PlayStation for the new console, so they copied them both. The Oye console looks exactly like a Sony PlayStation 4, and the game controller is a perfect replica of the Microsoft Xbox One controller. The company behind the theft is Shenzhen Oye Technology, which is crowdsourcing the project. They say the console will run Android. Lindsay Turrentine, I suspect that the more likely thing is that they photoshopped the PlayStation and the Xbox and just threw it into their Kickstarter. And they're either planning to never manufacture this game console, or they'll copy it, or they'll just come up with a design later once they have some money.
This kind of thing is so interesting to me, right? It's a little bit cultural. In China, it's not as weird to just completely rip something off. So whether or not they've actually made it or they have simply photoshopped it like you suggested, what's interesting to me is that there's anybody who would be like, oh, sure, yeah, I want that one.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's weird.
Yeah, I'm sure this tiny little crowdsourced startup that can't even come up with a unique design for the case is just a box. It's just like it's the easiest possible thing to come to be original with. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Good point. Unbelievable. Jason is pointing out that it's clearly very small because if you look at the size of the ports there.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I mean, that's the HDMI port right there. That's takes up like
10%. That seems like it might be a Photoshop error.
Yeah. Yeah. At least learn how to use Photoshop if you're going to steal other people's designs. All I'm saying. Our TNT fan of the day is Don LeCay, who posted this picture on Twitter and who's watching Tech News Today with his granddaughter.
Aww.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Get
go,
him early.
Granddaughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Show us how
Teacher
you watch.
Post.
Yeah. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup or your granddaughter and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Lindsay Turrentine, what the heck is going on in the world of CNET.com?
Well, we've got some big reviews coming in the next couple of days.
Samsung?
Maybe. Come back and see.
Maybe. All right. All right. Well, great stuff as always. CNET's a great site, of course. And thank you for co-anchoring today, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, Mike. See you next week.
All right. Bye. You can subscribe to Tech News Today by going to twit.tv/TNT and get lots more information as well. You can also watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1700 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and you can follow me on Vervid, by searching for Mike Elgin. What is Vervit? Well, it's a vertical video app. Check it out. Also, don't miss our other news show, Tech News, tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. Today's guest is Ron Richards. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. The show was produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Anthony Nielsen. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.